But I am with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, which is a very long name for a small institution. It is a rabbinical training program for students from Yeshiva University as well as from Israel, but it's also a community educational resource, which means that my job for much of the day is to go around having the fun of doing sessions like these, which I greatly enjoy. We specialize in medical ethics and business ethics and lawyer programs and Zionism and women's education and a whole range of other areas. So you may see our name around in different places in the community. What I wanted to do for this morning is to talk about the book of Bereishit, the book of Genesis, and to use it as a way to, well, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. We're just going to do it. You see the title. The title is Good and Evil in the Careers of Genesis. What can we learn from the trades that we find in Sefer Bereishit in the book of Genesis? If you take a look at the first source on your sheet, this is a comment from Rabbi Moses Nachmanides in the 13th century. On one of the purposes of this book of Genesis, you see he's troubled by something that troubled many scholars over the centuries. And that is that our Torah begins in the wrong place. If I were to look at Torah the way that many religions look at their books of law, I would expect to begin somewhere around the third portion in the book of Exodus, Parshat Bo, which is when the Jews are in Egypt. And Moses comes to them and he says, here's the first of your laws that you are going to receive, and it will be a book of laws. But it doesn't. It starts with stories. And stories that seem to have nothing to do with the formation of the Jewish people who are going to receive this text and are supposed to practice it. It starts out with, you know how it starts out. It starts out with the Garden of Eden and with creation and with Adam and Eve and Lemech and Cain and Noah and all these people who really don't figure much into the rest of it. And so the question the commentators ask is, why did you bother starting all the way back there? Was God paid by the word? And the one answer that's offered, the answer is yes. But no, one answer that's offered is here in source number one. Right, Moses Nachmanides, he quotes a rabbinic midrash, which says, Rabbi Yitzchak explained that the Torah began with, in the beginning, God created. And the story of creation until the creation of man. God gave him, Adam and Eve, control of his creation to put everything under his feet. The Garden of Eden, the choicest of places created in this world, was the place where man would rest until his sin chased him out. The generation of the flood was chased out of the world entirely due to their sins. The righteous one among them escaped with his children. The sins of their descendants caused God to scatter them. They settled places for their families and nations as occurred for them. What Nachmanides is trying to suggest here, and I only excerpted a piece of a much longer comment, is that the book of Genesis is intended as calibration. It's intended to teach us what God likes and what God doesn't like. What's going to get rewarded and what's going to get a person zapped. That's what it's there for. You know, when I was in university, I studied computer science, and one of the areas that I specialized in was language training and optical character recognition as well for the computer. And the way it worked was you would design a piece of software, you design a program for the computer, so the computer would learn to recognize letters. You could take a document, feed it into the computer, and the computer would figure out that what was on it were actually letters that were written there, and it could tell you what the letters are. Or it could hear people speak and figure out what was being said, breaking it down into letters and words. And one of the things that you had to do in order for this to succeed was you had to build in a calibration period, a period of time in which the computer would be exposed to this information with an answer key, so to speak, that the computer would be able to learn, oh, this is a letter R, this is a letter S. When it's shaped this way, it's a letter T. I guess much like what we do in grade school, right? Where first we need calibration. We need time just to learn things like that. And the same thing is true, says Nachmanides here, with the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is the calibration period for the Jewish people. You read this and you learn what God likes and what God doesn't like. Keeping that idea in mind, and there's more to be said about it, I've been told you get 1 hour and then people get very antsy. So that's fine, because after 1 hour I get really antsy, so this is okay. But the idea is that we are meant to understand from the events in the book of Bereshit, in the book of Genesis, we are meant to glean from this our calibration to understand what is approved and what is not approved. And so by looking at the careers of the figures who appear in this book, I want to learn lessons for what God likes and doesn't like, what we are supposed to do, what we are not supposed to do. And let's start off in general with the idea of a career, the idea of having a job. There's a word in Hebrew, lechatchila. Okay? Anybody familiar with that word? Know what it means? Okay, the word lechatchila means from the start, as it was meant to be at the beginning. And my question is, are careers lechatchila? Does God want people to have to go to work and earn a living from the very beginning of creation? Is that built in? Can you tell me yes or no, and preferably with support for the idea, for your answer? Yes?
I think yes. People were shepherds. They had to look out after the cultivation of the land in order to have food.
Mm-hmm. So we find shepherds and we find farmers. That's the suggestion made here, is that yes, God wants these careers because we find shepherds and farmers. However, those begin after they're kicked out of the garden. In the garden itself, before they eat from the fruit, does God want there to be careers? I saw a couple of other hands. Yes?
Well, he wants man to be man slash woman.
Yes. So the suggestion is that God wants human beings to have knowledge and to act appropriately, but I'm not sure I would classify that as necessarily having a career. Yes, we'll take one more and then maybe go a little forward with it. Yeah.
Cain and Abel did have careers in the garden.
Cain and Abel had careers, the suggestion is. Don't worry, when someone speaks and you can't hear, I'm going to repeat it. So.
Because that's why Cain. Something to God and from his fire, and Abel brought
Right, so the suggestion is Cain was indeed a farmer, and Abel was indeed a shepherd, and we're going to come back to that, but those are after they eat from the fruit and are kicked out of the garden. Within the garden itself, do we have any indication? The answer seems to be, yes, we do have one indication. Because the verse says in Genesis chapter 2, God puts them into the Garden of Eden to work it and to protect it. So there is, from the beginning, some sense that you're going to have to do something, but we don't know exactly what that is. And it seems not to be strenuous, because we're told about the water coming on its own, a mist coming up from the land. And we're told that God planted all the stuff for them, so there's nothing for them to plant. Now, maybe annuals, I suppose. You know, bring out the marigolds in the fall. But it appears, as you look at the text, it appears that whatever they're doing is not supposed to involve tremendous effort, but it changes when they eat from the fruit. Now, we could spend hours and hours on the story of them eating from the fruit and frankly get nowhere. But I'm going to make a long story short and say the following. The serpent approaches Eve and says, I got a fruit for you. Right? You know it's not an apple, right? Biblical text says nothing about apples. That's Christian artists who gave that to us for reasons beyond the scope of this current talk, except that you can blame St. Augustine for making it popular. If you take a look at source number 2, you find what the snake promises Eve. He says, "For God knows that on the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like gods, knowing good and evil." What does it mean to Eve? You will be like gods. What does that mean to Eve? What is she thinking that she's going to get when she eats from the fruit? Sorry? Power? Knowledge? Could be. These are good answers. Take a look at what the commentator Rashi said back in the 12th century. I think it's a remarkable insight. Rashi says, like gods, borei olamot, creators of worlds. Creators of worlds. Because what do they know about God until this point in time? The only thing they know is that God created. That's it. That's the sole piece of data they have, is that God is a creator. And so Rashi suggests what they want is to be able to create. Which makes a lot of sense in terms of the punishment that they receive. Because God says to them after the story plays out, that the punishment that they will receive is that Eve is going to be able to produce children, but it will be with great pain. And Adam is going to be able to bring fruit from the ground, but only also with great pain. He's going to plant this and something else is going to come up. God must have foreseen my garden. I planted one thing and I got back trouble as a result. That was it. That was what came up out of my garden. It was a hydrangea when I started. The idea is, you will be creators. You want to create? You bet. Eve, you're going to create life. But it's not a get-rich-quick scheme, right? Eat the fruit and then you're going to be a creator. It doesn't work that way. It's going to be with pain. Adam, you're going to bring life out of the soil. You're going to put fruit in the ground. It's going to deteriorate. And there's going to be a life that's going to emerge. But it's going to be with a lot of pain. You can be a creator, but it doesn't come easy. That's the message that we get from them eating from the fruit, and there they officially gain the first idea of you're going to need to create and support yourselves. You're going to go out into the world because they're kicked out of the garden, kicked out of this lush place where God has given them all the trees and all the plants, and now you're going to have to make a go of it yourself. And there's another piece. Because it isn't only a promise of you will be creators. Go back to source number 2, please. Look at the biblical sentence. God knows on the day you eat from it, this is again the promise of the snake. On the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like gods, knowing good and evil. You will also know good and evil. What's the evil? What is this evil, I think I heard somebody ask over there, what is the evil that they are now going to learn? It appears that in the act of creation, built in to being a creator, is an element of good and an element of evil. And as they go out to shape their world, as they go out to develop the means of their survival, they're going to experience trades, careers, which are going to bring with them the potential for great good and the potential for great harm. And that is where we want to go with this. There are three careers that I want to focus on today that are found in the book of Genesis. One was already mentioned, the farmer. Number 2 was also already mentioned, and that's the shepherd. And then there's a third career that appears a couple of times in the book of Genesis, less so than the others, but I think equal in importance, and that is the hunter. Farmer, shepherd, hunter. And what we're going to do, I hope, over the next 40 minutes or so, is look at the good and evil of each of these as expressed in the events of the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis. So, farmers in Genesis. Who do you know who's a farmer in the book of Genesis? Don't cheat and look at your sheet. That's not fair. Cain is the first farmer. Very good. Well, not so good for him, but good answer. Yes, Cain is a farmer. Who else? Isaac is a farmer. True. Does rather well. Noah. Noah's a farmer. Doesn't work out so well. And the Egyptians are farmers. Moving to the end of the book of Genesis, the Egyptians are farmers, and we'll have to see quite a bit about the Egyptians as well. By the way, if I wander from the mic and you can't hear me, let me know, please. I'm not used to the microphone thing. If you take a look at source number 3, you find the description of Cain and Hevel, Cain and Abel, the sons of Adam and Eve. And Abel was a shepherd. More about the shepherds later. And Cain was a worker of the land. I brought you the Hebrew as well there. Oved Adama. That's a very important phrase. We're going to come back to that. And it was at the end of days. End of days does not mean apocalyptic. It just means after a period of time. So it was at the end of days. And Cain brought a gift for God from the fruit of the land. And Abel also brought from the first of his sheep and from their fat. And God turned to Abel and to his offering, my apologies to the vegetarians. So Cain is a farmer. Even brings a gift from the produce to God. That's one. Number 2, take a look at source number 4. Noah, after the flood. And Noah, man of the earth, and there again I brought you the Hebrew, Ish Ha'adama, started out and he planted a vineyard. And then, in source number 5, we have Yitzchak, Isaac. And Isaac planted in that land and he found 100-fold that year. And God blessed him. He didn't know Jews could be good farmers. Right? There you go. And then, in source number 6, a verse from Ecclesiastes. Well, actually, no, I'm going to hold off on number 6. The other group that we know about is indeed the Egyptians as farmers. We know that they use the waters of the Nile for their fields. And we know that they planted, because if you remember at the end of the book of Genesis, you get the 7 years of famine, right? 7 years of plenty, and then they're supposed to have 7 years of famine. They actually had 2. When you look at the biblical account, it stops in the second year when Jacob and his family come down to Egypt, the famine ends. But you find their reliance on that which they can grow from the ground. Okay, so how do we look at these farmers? We have 4 farmers, or 3 farmers and a group of farmers. Cain, Noah, Isaac, and the Egyptians. Cain, good or bad? Sorry, bad is the only right answer on this one. It's rare in biblical texts that you can do that and say incontrovertibly. But when you're the first murderer in human history, it's hard to redeem that. So, Cain brings his offering to God. God rejects the offering. Why does God reject the offering? He's the first one to bring one to God, right? So we'll have to talk about that. But God rejects his offering, accepts his brother's offering. Cain gets angry, and he murders his brother. So, yeah, we put him on... You know what? I have a blackboard. There, I put Cain on the bad list. I hope it's large enough for everybody to see. I don't know. But Cain is on the negative list. Is God at fault for rejecting his offering? We'll have to talk about that a little. Next one, Noah. Good list or bad list? Good list, right? I mean, he and his family survive when no one else is. He's described as being very righteous. How do we view him in the context of being a farmer? Planted a vineyard and then... Then he got drunk, and then we know the rest of the story, right? So his farming career, good or bad?
Short.
Well, we don't actually know. She suggests that his farming career was brief, but the truth of the matter is, we don't know what happens for the rest of his life. Presumably he's out there farming, we don't know. But I'm going to put Noah, controversially perhaps, on the bad list in terms of his farming. His farming experience is not a good one.
Could you explain that?
Yes. Noah, when he plants his vineyard, it's interesting, because you're right, Noah's story is complex. In rabbinic literature, Noah is praised for going out to plant. This is an act of building up the world. It's a good thing. But the biblical text very clearly condemns his choice of planting. His choice is to go out immediately and plant a vineyard, and then take the grapes and make wine, and to get drunk on the wine. That's not considered positive. And he's disgraced in his drunkenness, and that's why I put it on the bad side. Not because he is bad, but because his farming, the only biblical record of his farming, again, is a negative. Isaac, on the other hand, God blesses him, rewards him 100-fold. If you're familiar with the community in Israel, in Jerusalem, Mea She'arim, 100-fold is the way that's described biblically, even though Mea She'arim you think of as 100 gates. But it's 100-fold in this biblical text that I brought you in source number 5. So, Isaac is on the good list in terms of his farming experience. The Egyptians are neutral, value neutral in this regard. Neither bad nor good, they simply are farmers. For these four, Cain, his offering is rejected by God, compared with the sheep. Seems to indicate a preference for shepherding over farming. It's not going to be that easy, but it seems to indicate that. I've got to come back to that thought. Noah goes from being described pre-flood as Ish Tzadik, a righteous person. And then post-flood he's described as Ish Ha'adama, a person of the land. There seems to be a contrast where he has gone downhill. And Isaac is helped by God in his farming. So let's see what we can do with these stories in terms of getting good or bad out of this. Well, first of all, the bad. Cain, I mentioned that I brought you the Hebrew in source number 3, is described as Oved Adama, a worker of the land. Anybody know the Hebrew word for a slave? Eved. Right, Eved. He is a slave to the land. If you take a look at source number 6, a verse from Ecclesiastes, the benefit of a land anywhere is in a king who is enslaved to the field, meaning the nation will survive if his king is someone who works the land too. The king is a hard worker, not just somebody who enjoys the feasts and the parties, but who's out there working. That's a good thing. However, the last part of it, melech l'sadeh ne'evad, you can't work a field as a hobby. We garden as a hobby. But if you work a field, that requires total dedication. From the time that you are plowing the land and breaking it up, to the planting, to the irrigation, to the protection from wild animals, to nurturing it as it comes along and pulling out all the weeds, to the harvest time, and I'm probably skipping steps because what do I know about farming, but from the beginning, I grew up in New York, from the beginning of the season until the end of the season, and this is months and months long, the farmer is a slave to the field. Cain is Oved Adama, a slave of the land. As a matter of fact, well, I'll come back to the matter of fact in 1 second, Noah is described as Ish Ha'adama, the man of the land. He doesn't own the land owns him. The land owns the person. It dominates the person's identity. And now let's go back to Cain's offering. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, notes, if you take a look at that verse that I brought you in source number 3, when it talks about the offering that was brought, it says, Cain brought a gift for God, mipri ha'adama, from the fruit of the land. It's the land's fruit. As opposed to when Abel brings his gift, it's from the first of his sheep. There isn't the same sense. I'm sorry? The difference is that when you're dealing with the land, it's the land that owns the produce. You are a servant of the land to get it out of the land. Whereas with the sheep, as we're going to see, there's a much greater sense that you are what's called in Hebrew the Baal. You are the one who is the owner, the proprietor, if you will. It's not really the best translation of the word Baal, but it'll do. But you are the one who is the proprietor of the land. It's Abel's own sheep. The sheep are his, which is why it's a better sacrifice to God, because he's taking something that actually is his. But the point that I wanted to make with it is that the problem with farming and the negative side to it is the way that one becomes a slave to the physical enterprise. The way that one becomes a slave to the material enterprise that dominates your life, it dominates your focus. On the other hand, also emerging from the biblical text, is a positive of farming. And that is the dependence on God and the sense of loyalty that can come from that. If you take a look at the... the verse that we use to describe Isaac, he is blessed by God. That's the way Isaac looks at his produce. He looks at his success and says, God has helped me. And you see it again in source number 7. Source number 7 describes the problem Isaac had, which we're going to talk about more in a little bit. And that was that he had dug wells in the Philistine area, in what is today Gaza. And each time he dug a well, the Philistines filled it in. They didn't want him there, for reasons we're going to come back to. Until finally he digs one well, and there's no fight over that well. And that's what he says, what he has here in source number 7. They moved from there and dug another well and did not fight over it. And he, Isaac, called it Rehovot, like the city today, Rehovot, saying, for now God has broadened Hirchiv, the space for us. Rachav means to be broad, spacious. God has given us space. We have multiplied in the land. He attributes his success to God. That's the positive of the farmer. You see, the flip side of being a farmer and being so at the mercy of the elements is that you come to recognize just how little we control our own fate. You can't become arrogant when, if rain disappears for a week, everything you've been working on for months is gone and the family's going to starve. It's very hard to be arrogant because you realize just how powerless you are. And so the farmer, if the farmer is spiritually focused, then the farmer comes to a relationship with God as a result of it. And you can see it in the multiplicity of biblical commandments that are tied to farming. All sorts of tithes that have to be given to different parties. Bringing the first fruits. Leaving the gleaning for the needy. Laws of how you plow. Laws of how you harvest. There are all sorts of laws related to it to explicitly connect the farming experience with your relationship with God. So that there is a tov and there is a ra, there is a good and there is a bad. The downside of the farming is this slavery to the material world. To become an oved adama, a servant of the land. And I think that has a lesson for us in terms of our own lives. Not to become so wrapped up in our work that our identity becomes slave of whatever the job is. But also the positive side of it, which is the opportunity to recognize that success isn't just about what I do, but that there's a hand of God involved as well. There's much more we could say about that. Isaac is described biblically as going out into the fields to pray. There's much more about this, but I want to move on to the shepherd. And I realize that I'm not affording much opportunity for question and discussion right now because I'm trying to get through a lot of material with it. But if there's something that's bothering you, just shout it out and we'll try to address it. But I want to go to the shepherd now. This book of Genesis is full of shepherds. You can't read a chapter without tripping over a shepherd. It's true. Maybe a chapter. But we already saw Abel as a shepherd. That was what we saw in source number 3. He's a shepherd. He brings from the first of his sheep. He brings the fat. There's another shepherd by the name of Yaval, who is mentioned, but we don't really get much detail about him. I didn't even bring a sheep for him. I'm just going to get rid of the farmers. Given that God accepts Abel's offering, and given that we know nothing else about his very short life, I'm going to put Abel on the good list. Okay? Abel is on the good list. This farmer who is mentioned, Yaval, who was a son of Lamech, we know zero about, except that he was a farmer. So I'm not going to put him on good or bad. I don't know. Abraham is a shepherd. He's got lots of cattle, as we'll see in a moment. Good, I hope? Can we say that? Okay. In truth, it's cheating to put him on here because his goodness isn't related to his farming. To his shepherding, I'm sorry. He's good because he's good. We don't find it in relation to being a shepherd. Nonetheless, we'll leave him on because he's Abraham. The next shepherd we find is Lot.
Bad.
Lot is a problem biblically on many, many levels. As a matter of fact, his name is actually a word in Aramaic which admits of two meanings. One is hidden. The other is a curse. And when you read his story, you realize why. I mean, we're going to see a piece of it here. Lot is deserving of his own class. But take a look at source number 8. Look at this story. Lot, who traveled with Abram, also possessed sheep, cattle, and tents. Also meaning like Abram, who had these things, Lot does too. And the land could not support them to live together, for they had much property. They could not dwell together. There was a fight between the shepherds of Abram's cattle and the shepherds of Lot's cattle. We don't have enough room. Lot raised his eye. What happens in the interlude there, where I skipped, is that Abram says to Lot, look, there isn't enough space. Take whatever you want, and I'll go wherever you don't go. If you want to go to the right, I'll go left. If you want to go left, I'll go right. Whatever you like. So Lot raised his eyes, and he saw the plain of the Jordan entirely irrigated before God destroyed Sodom and Amorah. Sodom, I prefer in the Hebrew. This is the area that is today known as the Dead Sea, right? The plain of the Jordan is as it runs south and the land smooths out. That's the area that comes to this deposit of water that we know as the Dead Sea. So he sees this area, and it's all irrigated, like the Garden of God, like the land of Egypt, which benefits from the water of the Nile, as you come to a city called Zoar. And Lot selected the entire plain of the Jordan, and he moved his tent to Sodom, which tells you something about his skills as a real estate agent. Location, location, location. So Lot decides he wants to move to Sodom. That's his decision about where he's going to go. Because he's a shepherd, his shepherding leads him to seek out this very irrigated, lush land, and it gets him into a lot of trouble. We're going to come back to that more, but right now I'm putting Lot on the bad side. There's more to be said. We're coming back to that and why he's on the bad side. Then we have the Philistine shepherds who we just read about, the ones who filled in Isaac's wells. You want to know why they filled them in? Take a look at source number 9, bottom of the first side. And all the wells dug by the servants of his father Abraham, the Philistines blocked them, filling them with dirt. And the shepherds of Gerar, the Philistine city, fought with the shepherds of Isaac, saying, the water is ours. The story is that the shepherds don't want to share. They failed kindergarten. The shepherds of the Philistine sheep, they want water for their sheep, and they want to keep other sheep out. Yes, we're going to put the Philistines on the bad list. With my apologies, but yeah. Samson agrees with me. The next one we know is Isaac. Isaac is good, but we don't actually know that it has to do with being a shepherd, although God rewards him in his planting. We don't know much about his shepherding. So I'm gonna put him off to the side on the good. He's good, but not because he's a shepherd. And then the next shepherd we find biblically is Rachel, right? She brings the animals down to the well. She's good. Again, not known to be good because she's a shepherd, but known to be good in general biblically. Then we get her father. Her father, Laban, or Laban, and his sons. Yeah, we're not into them. They're a problem. And their problem is specifically that they are jealous of others' success and growth. Take a look at source number 10, please. And Jacob heard the words of the sons of Laban, saying, Jacob had taken all that our father possessed. From our father's property he created all of this wealth. And Jacob saw Laban's face, that he was not with him as he had been previously. And we know how the story plays out. Laban tries to cheat him of his salary, does not want to give him for his honest work, takes advantage of Jacob in a whole host of ways, in terms of shepherding and in terms of issues like who he's going to marry. Laban, bad side. And then we get Jacob himself. Jacob is a shepherd. He's a good shepherd. Take a look at source number 11. When Laban pursues Jacob, Jacob leaves. When he sees that Laban is against him, he runs away with his family. He is caught by Laban, who catches up to this family as it moves along. And Laban accuses him of stealing from him. We know the story with what Rachel took. That's its own story and its own discussion. And Jacob turns to him and says, "You know, I've been with you for 20 years. Your lambs and goats never lost any young. Not because the animals don't lose young, but what he's saying is, I made it up to you. If they lost anything, I paid for it out of my own pocket. I never ate the rams of your sheep. I never brought a torn animal to you. I made up the loss from my own hand. You sought it, whether stolen by day or night. Whatever happened, whatever you lost, an animal was attacked by wolves, an animal was stolen by somebody, doesn't matter. I made it up personally. I was eaten by heat in the day and ice at night, and sleep flew from my eyes. Jacob said, I was a good shepherd for 20 years. What are you accusing me now of being a thief?" That's his statement to him. Jacob is, first of all, we consider him to be on the good side, and it's tied to the responsibility he takes for the welfare of the sheep. I'm putting Jacob on the good side. And then, Joseph's brothers are shepherds. I'm not sure what side and what to do with that one. Their nature... We're taught traditionally that they are righteous. I'm focusing right now on what the shepherding, how I should look at their shepherding career. We really don't know. We only know that they're shepherds because when they end up selling him, they've been out, taking care of the sheep. And then the Jews themselves are identified as shepherds when they go down to Egypt. And we're going to come back to that in a bit. But again, for that, I don't know good or bad. It's not presented with enough information. But what can we learn from the good side and the bad side of these shepherds? Well, first of all, the negative. When we look at what we have on the negative side, Lot, who wants more land, better land, for his sheep to graze, and therefore he goes to stone. The Philistines, who want more water for their sheep, and they want to chase out Isaac with his sheep. And Laban, who wants everything for himself and doesn't even want to pay the shepherd who's been so loyal to him for 20 years. You're developing a picture here, right? The shepherd is at risk of developing greed. And the reason for it is simple. Unlike the farmer who has a plot of land and that's what he's going to work and that's it, the shepherd is always looking for more land to graze. The shepherd is always looking for a new water supply for the sheep. It's natural for the shepherd to become greedy. And that's what underlies what happens there. The fallout between Abraham and Lot is a perfect example. Take a look at source number 12, Rashi's commentary in the 12th century to that incident and what the fight was about between these shepherds on the two sides. Rashi informs us, Lot's shepherds were wicked, grazing their animals in the fields of others. Abram's shepherds rebuked them for theft. And they said, Lot's shepherds said, "The land has been given to Abram. God promised it already. He has no heir. Lot is his heir. And so this is not theft. We're going to get it eventually anyway." Not the international relations. But the theme of it, and what Rashi is expanding on, is this theme of wanting. And so, if you flip back to the first side, there's a telling word in source number 8. Towards the end of it, Lot raised his eyes, saw the plain of the Jordan, and so on. And Lot selected, the Hebrew says, et kol kikar hayarden, the entire plain of the Jordan. That's a ridiculously large swath of land for one person's sheep. I don't care who you are. I don't care how much sheep you have. The entire plain of the Jordan is mine. That's an area that would come to be inhabited by five cities. you don't need that much land, Lot. Yeah, but my sheep are going to grow, and what do I get to do next year? It's about greed. And as a matter of fact, where does he move? The city of Sodom, which is destroyed for the as a punishment for greed. That's what Lot is about. That's what Sodom is about. And it fits in also with his children. His son was going to be named Moab, was born out of this incident with the destruction of Sodom, and Moab itself becomes a nation of greed. It goes beyond the scope of what we're going to see right now. The Philistine shepherds fight over the water supply. Laban and his sons are greedy. As a matter of fact, this is an interesting point. There's a fight between the Egyptians and the Jews. Well, an almost fight, when the Jews descend to Egypt. Take a look, please, at source number 13. Joseph is preparing his brothers for their meeting with the Pharaoh. The brothers have now come down. Joseph wants to set them up in the land, and he gives them advice. He says, listen, tell the Egyptians, your servants have been shepherds from our youth until now, us and our ancestors, so that you will live in Goshen, for Egypt abhors shepherds. Why did Egypt abhor shepherds? What's wrong with shepherds? We like them. They make nice artwork, you know? Points like under the tree, in the bucolic field. What is it that makes the Egyptians hate the shepherds?
Sheep
take over the land. They destroy the land that the farmers want to plant. There's another idea also about the sheep being a worshipped animal in Egypt. And that's a separate note. But we know that the Egyptians raised sheep. We know they had shepherds because one of the... Take a look at source number 14. This is Pharaoh's response to the brothers. He says, Egypt is before you. Place your father and brothers in the best of the land. Let them dwell in Goshen. If you know that there are men of strength among them, place them as officers over my cattle. So he has animals. Now, whether cattle and sheep are to be distinguished is an interesting question. But they are raising animals, but they don't like shepherds among them because shepherds are land thieves. They're forever looking for land to raise their animals in, and the farmers hate them. It creates great cultural hostility. As a matter of fact, if you move forward from biblical times to the laws of the Jews who enter the land of Canaan that becomes Israel, take a look at source number 15. This is from the Mishnah, core text of the Talmud. It's written down in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era, but it existed long before then. One may not raise light animals in Israel. Light animals are sheep and goats. There's a prohibition stated against raising them in Israel. Why? So, good question. If you take a look at the next line there in source 15, the commentator Rashi says, for the sake of settling Israel, because they destroy the fields. These animals eat everything up. Maimonides writes a generation later, for they extend into the fields. They eat from one field, then they go into the next field, and they take from other people's property. Either way, there is this concern for what shepherds end up doing. They end up expanding into other people's land, and they ruin the land that they have, and for little gain. So that's the negative side of farming. Of shepherding. The negative side is this potential for greed and expansion into other people's property. The good side, though, of being a shepherd is that you take care of others. Remember that I noted that Abel brings his offering, mibechorot sono, from the first of his sheep. How does it become his sheep? Because he does the work of caring for them. Unlike lamb, sheep have a personality. They're a living being. And you involve yourself in chesed, in an act of generosity, of taking care of someone else. If you look at Jacob and his great care that he extends on behalf of the sheep, the term to be a shepherd in English, as well as Biblical Hebrew, is a term for caring for somebody. If you take a look at source number 16, Jacob describes God as Elohim haro'eh oti, ro'eh with an ayin for those who know Hebrew. is a shepherd. I put the translation here. The God who has herded me from my birth to this very day. There's a sense of the shepherd as a protector. If you think of the story, this is beyond the book of Genesis, but the story of Moshe, of Moses, right? Why is he chosen to lead the Jews? Why him? He is a shepherd. But the biblical account of that story with the burning bush where God appears to him is, it begins, Moshe hayaro'eh etzon yidro chotno achar hamidbar. Moshe was shepherding the sheep of his father-in-law Yitro in the wilderness, and he led the sheep, and then he came to Horeb and he saw the bush and so on. The rabbi said it's not coincidence that we present Moshe as shepherd with the scene in which God selects him. It's because he exerted himself on behalf of the sheep. There's even that whole story in the Midrash about the little sheep that runs away. Right? Have you ever heard this? The little sheep that runs away in search of water, and he runs after it, and he sees that it's thirsty, and he picks it up, and he takes it to the well to drink. And God says, that's the one I want. Which is why, later on, Moses describes his job as Kasher Yisad Ha'omenet Hayonek, to carry the Jews the way a nursemaid carries a nursling. That's the job. It's chesed. It's kindness. It's taking care of others. And that is what we see in the shepherd. And so we see potential for... Hold on one second. Okay, go ahead.
We refer to God as a shepherd.
Yes, precisely. Just like in source 16. But you're right, we do it in our own liturgy. We talk about God as a shepherd. Hashem ro'i lo asar, like in Psalm 23. God is my shepherd, I shall not lack, right? So, going back again to the Garden of Eden, where we learn that careers have tov vara, they have good and evil. The evil of being a shepherd is the greed that can come with it as you need to expand further and further. The plus side, the positive of it, the tov, is being a person of chesed, of kindness, exerting oneself constantly on behalf of those sheep. Third and last of our careers. This one is the shortest of the bunch because we only have two hunters in the book of Genesis. And I don't need to use the good and bad list because I think you'll be able to tell me. First one is Nimrod. Second one is Esau. Nimrod is actually an interesting story. His account. Take a look at source number 17. He lives in between the flood and the time of Abraham. He overlaps with Abraham. The biblical text tells us, and Cush fathered Nimrod, who became mighty in the land. That means if he's from Cush, he's from Ham, the son of Noah, who generally is considered the worst of the three. Nimrod becomes mighty in the land. He was a mighty trapper before God. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty trapper before God. That was apparently a thing people would say. People would say, oh, he's like Nimrod, a mighty trapper before God. Okay? And the first of his empire was Babylon, and then it goes on to describe where he lived. We also know, in addition to this, that, and I didn't bring it on the sheet just in the interest of space, the text continues from here to describe the story of the Tower of Babel. Knowing that the first of his empire was Babylon, and the next story is the tower built in Babylon, leads the sages to conclude that that's actually on his watch. He is the leader of this construction of the Tower of Babel, which God foils. God clearly does not consider a positive. Now, there are a lot of views as to what was bad about the Tower of Babel. It's beyond the scope of what we're going to get to today. But the point is, he is viewed as a hunter, a mighty trapper. I've translated the word as trapper because that's truer to the Hebrew. The word in Hebrew that's used for hunter is sayad. And that's really a term for trapping rather than killing per se. So I rendered it as a trapper here. But he is described as a mighty hunter, a mighty trapper before God. And he is a negative. And now we get Esau, as in, you know, the one who wanted to kill his brother. Right? I mean, he was upset about losing the birthright. He was upset about how his brother bought off of him the blessing. But take a look at source number 18. And the youths matured. The youths being Esau and Jacob. Esau and Yaakov. The youths matured. And Esau was a trapper and a man of the field. And Jacob was simple, a dweller of tents. And Isaac loved Esau for the trapping in his mouth. Taken simply, he gave him dinner. And Rebekah loved Jacob. Esau is viewed, as I said, as negative. He expresses disdain for the birthright, which is so precious within his family. He marries wives from Canaan who make his parents miserable. It's an old story. But the biblical text says, "Vatihena morat ruach liyitzchak ulirivka." They cause a bitter spirit to Isaac and Rebekah. He reneges on his deal to sell the birthright to his brother and tries to get it anyway. There's a discussion about the birthright, the blessing. And then he says he's going to kill his brother. That also, we're going back to Cain and Abel. Negative. We see negative character in both Nimrod, associated with the Tower of Babel, and Esau. What can I learn from them? Is there anything that I can learn from them? Quite possibly. Because both of them, we are taught, engage in this career of hunting, this career of trapping, and that has a negative built into it. What do you have to be good at in order to trap animals? Even the trapping, before you get to the killing. You have to be sneaky. You have to be a deceiver. There's nothing inherently wrong from the perspective of Jewish law with hunting for food. Right? Leave aside vegetarianism, because my daughter is a vegetarian and she won't forgive me if I say anything on that regard. But in terms of hunting for food, assuming you do all the rules, you fulfill all the mitzvot related to kosher slaughter, to shechita, okay, so you've covered that base. They're allowed, not in the beginning of the Torah, but in Genesis chapter 9, they're told you're allowed to eat meat. Granted, there are responsa through the centuries about hunting, and in general they said it's not a very nice thing for Jews to be involved with. There's an element of cruelty, certainly, if it's not going to be used. Nonetheless, it's not the act of killing, per se, that bothers us. Especially when you see that Isaac loved him. Isaac knows where this stuff is coming from. He knows where the food is coming from. That's not the negative. But it's possible to argue that the problem is indeed the problem of deception involved. Go back to that verse about Nimrod. It said he was a mighty trapper before God. Source 19, Rashi, seeks to explain that. He says we're not really being told about what Nimrod does for a living, being a mighty trapper in that sense. Because it says a mighty trapper before God. What does that mean? You want to say he's a mighty trapper? Say he's a mighty trapper. Mighty trapper before God suggests there's something religious going on here. What is it? And so Rashi takes it in a negative way. He says trapping the minds of people with his mouth, misleading them to rebel against God. A mighty trapper in front of God, keeping people from serving God. That's Rashi there, and he follows up with a comment regarding Esav. Take a look at the second comment in source number 19. When the verse said that Isaac loved Esav for the trapping in his mouth, Rashi quotes a midrash. A midrash explains, in Esav's mouth, not putting food into Isaac's mouth. Esav is trapping with his mouth. He trapped Isaac, fooling him with his words, and the midrash goes on to explain how Esav presents himself as righteous, and he asks his father all sorts of deceptive questions to fool him into thinking that he is righteous. Jacob was presented as Ishtam, simple, very straightforward. That's the opposite of the hunter, who is not simple and straightforward. The hunter has plans going in his head. The hunter tells you one thing and is thinking something else. That's the idea of the hunter. There's much more about this in the biblical commentaries. One called Kli Yakar notes that we're told that Esav is a very hairy person, and he talks about him as hiding his true nature behind the coat of hair. And in fact, interestingly, when Jacob gets the birthright, what does he do? He deceives, but how does he do it? He puts the hair on his arms, right? Takes the goat skin to put the hair on his arms so that he will seem to be like his brother. He becomes a trapper. And it comes back to haunt him. Because when his son Joseph is sold, what do his kids do? They take a goat, they slaughter it, they dip the coat in the blood, and they trap him with their mouths. And And then they end up down in Egypt at the mercy of their brother Joseph, who traps them with his mouth. It's this cycle of deception that runs through the generations there, the deceiver becoming the deceived. But my point is that the negative in the trade of hunting is this trade of deception that one learns. I don't know a positive. For those who are worried, like, oh no, he only has like 6 minutes left and he hasn't given us a positive yet in hunting, it's easy because I don't know. I look at the biblical text, I can't find it. Yes?
When you're hunting for food, correct?
Yes.
Meat?
Yeah.
Well, if that's negative, why do we eat meat?
Right. So the negative, I believe, is not actually in the killing of the meat, because as you said, it's biblically permitted. The negative is in the deception and the trapping. And what I'm suggesting is, every trade that we're talking about is permissible. Shepherding, permissible. Farming, permissible. Trapping, permissible. However, you can learn positive traits from it, or you can learn negative traits from it. So, I'm going to sum up what we've said in like one sentence. Okay, yeah.
When you say, and Jacob was sinful, there is some more explanation about sinful, and I would like you to tell me what you think in the world of sinful. Would he be not very bright?
That's a really good question. That's a really good question. Can we explain when we say Jacob was simple, what that means with greater depth? So the word in Hebrew that's used is tum. Tum in Hebrew means without a blemish, without a defect. And it has two different meanings as it's used. Sometimes it's used to indicate that one is perfect, righteous. Sometimes it's used to mean simple in the sense of not particularly bright. So it admits of both meanings. The way that it's used here with Jacob, and the reason I translated it as simple, I meant simple as in straightforward, is because it's in opposition with the trapper. The trapper deceives, and he is simple and straightforward. That's why I took it this way here, but you're right, the word is more complex. Simple is complex. Go figure. But to sum up what we've said, Adam and Eve in the garden are not supposed to have difficult, life-consuming careers. They turn to the serpent. The serpent says, you know, if you eat this, you'll become creators like God. And you will know good and evil. And both of those come true. Eve is going to bring life from herself with pain, but she's going to be a creator. Adam is going to bring life from the ground with pain, but he's going to be a creator. But it's going to come with knowledge of good and evil. There are things you're going to learn in the course of your creation that are going to be good and they're going to be bad. In the career of the farmer, we find the negative in the sense that he's enslaved to the land and he becomes so focused on the material. But on the other hand, there's a positive if he learns to recognize the hand of God in his work, how dependent he is on God for assistance, as Isaac does. Then we add the shepherd. And the negative of the shepherd is this need to constantly find more grazing land and more water leads to greed. But on the other hand, there's the positive of devotion to taking care of the sheep. And then we have the hunter, for which I have the negative of learning deception, learning how to trap, and learning how to fool others, as used by Esau and Nimrod. And I can't come up with a positive. I can't find yet. That doesn't mean it's not there. It means I couldn't find it. But that would be homework then. If you look on your sheet, you will see on the top of the first side my email address. If you want to follow up, and certainly if you can come up with something positive for the hunter, I would love to hear it. That would make me feel like this is more complete. Marjorie, thank you so much for setting this up. Thank you, everybody, for being here.